Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark and Acedo podcast. My name is Mark and Acedo, and I'm back with a vengeance. It's been a while since I did a podcast, but I'm back and I hope to be back more often here. I'm still in the process of researching my next episode, the next of the series I'm working on history and music of the year 1967. It's a busy year in music, so I'm still in the process of researching it, so bear with me. It'll be up as soon as I finish. So I had a pleasure to interview another musician of that period. She was a folk singer. Her name is Melanie. Melanie was known for the 1971-72 global hit Brand New Key, her cover of the Rolling Stones' Ruby Tuesday, her composition What Have I Done to My Song Ma, and her 1970 international breakthrough hit Lay Down, Candles in the Wind, which was inspired by her experience performing at Woodstock back in 1969. I felt very honored interviewing her. She was very informative about what she talked about. My dog's in the background. You can hear him. She had a very, very, very great description of Woodstock. It was like you were almost there with her, experiencing this. It was really amazing. Interestingly enough, I had to do two separate episodes of this. Well, one episode, and when I was doing it on Zoom for the video, I actually stopped it and I paused it, so I had to start over again on another video of the last question, because I had a emergency that came up, and so it's kind of awkward how that happened, but whatever, it worked out in the end anyway. It was a great interview. Again, I was honored to have interviewed her. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Here is my interview with Melanie back in March. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Mark and Acedo podcast. I'm Mark and Acedo. I'm honored to be interviewing today's guest. She is a folk singer, songwriter, known for her cover of the Rolling Stones' original Ruby Tuesday, and her compositions What Had I Done to My Song Ma, the global hit Brand New Key, and the international breakthrough hit Lay Down, Candles in the Rain, which was inspired by her performance at Woodstock in 1969. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Melanie.
Hi, everybody.
So first I want to ask you, when did your love of music first come about?
I grew up with music. You know, I just thought this is the way it was. You know, I grew up with an Italian grandmother, and she sang, mm-hmm. You know, she would walk down the street and she would just break into song, and it was just part of my life, you know, growing up. And I never really thought that it was something that I could do as a career involving music, because, you know, it was unreachable. You know, that was for some of the other people. But for me, the love of music was just something I was born with. You know, I was just lucky to be born into a family that was musical. My Uncle George played the guitar, and he sang songs of labor songs, and my grandmother sang Italian songs, and my mother sang blues and jazz. So I grew up with all of those influences, and it was just part of my upbringing.
That's cool. That's really cool. What was the inspiration for your first record, Beautiful People? Yes, yeah.
Well, there was a connectedness that seemed to happen the night before. There was a blackout in New York City, and I was living in the city in an apartment with two other girls, and we Yeah, it was very exciting, you know, this blackout and what's going to happen. And we had emergency candles and we were passing them out. And there was this vibe in the city of everyone helping each other, you know, and there was this, it just brought out that, you know, that innate feeling of this is what we're here for, you know, right. This is really what we're here for, and that we're all connected somehow. And the next day, I was on a bus and a lunatic came onto the bus and he was, you know, just spouting out things and saying ridiculous stuff. And, you know, the people on the bus little by little just started looking at each other and laughing. And we were laughing at him and we were laughing at our own reactions, and it just brought it again, just reminded me that we were connected, and that it was those two events happening in that sequence. And I just kept thinking, beautiful people, and that we all have the same basic, we all want the same things, you know, we want to live in peace. We want to do well. We want our kids to do well. We want, you know, to share. And you always feel better when you're helping someone else, you know, so.
That's true. That's amazing. That's an amazing story. You played 40 straight shows in Paris at the Olympia Theater. How was that experience? That's got to be tiring. Well,
that was pretty unbelievable. I was a person who had never left the United States. So, I hadn't left the North America. I had been to Canada, but I was immersed in another culture. You know, I was in Paris and I was the protege of Gilbert Bécaud. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was like the Frank Sinatra of Europe. Very high energy guy. And he thought that I would go over really well in France. And again, he had come to America and seen me, and he decided he wanted to bring me and present me to the French public. And he was doing the Olympia Theater. He was the star of the show. And he had me a second on the bill. Again, I hadn't done very much performing. I always sang, but I wasn't thinking this was something I could do as a career or something I would be able to do as a living. And so I was presented. Now, this show was very much in that glitzy variety show, you know, with there'd be acrobats and there were comedians and pop singers and folk singers and singers from Russia and dancers, and they had something called the New York City Ballet. They were not exactly ballet dancers. They were more like, they were dressed in mostly feathers. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of clothes on. And they were the New York City Ballet. But there were so many different kinds of acts. But again, there was Gilbert Bécaud, the big star, and he was presenting me. I was second on the bill to Gilbert Bécaud. And Bruno Coquetrix was the presenter. Now he presented everybody in Paris. He presented Edith Piaf. And so we're at the dress rehearsal and I walk on stage, very uneventful kind of a presentation. You know, it's just, I just clumped on stage and sat on my chair and started to sing. And Bruno Coquetrix is talking to Gilbert Bécaud in the corner, and I can see him gesturing wildly, like, no, this won't do, this is no good. And Gilbert Bécaud is, you know, wait. And so he's, no. And he stopped me in the middle of my song. And he said, we have to have some presentation, you know. I know the French public and they will not like this. And I don't know, you know. It wasn't like I went to school for, you know, how to be a singer dancer on Broadway or something, you know. I was very much an introvert, and I kind of presented myself the way I was in real life. So when he heard, he saw what I was about to do, he thought this would be a catastrophe. So what he did was, there was this huge golden staircase behind me on the stage, and he thought a good idea would be to have the New York City Ballet lining the staircase. And I would descend from the top and come out from a curtain and walk down the stairs to this da 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 kind of music. And at the bottom of the stairs, the last ballet dancer in her feathers would hand me the guitar. And so I tried several times. I'm not the most graceful stair descender. And I tried to kind of do what he thought, but it was very comedic, really. I can only imagine. I wish I had a video of that, because it must have been very funny. I got to the bottom of the stairs, and the girl from the New York City Ballet handed me my guitar, and then I just kind of clumped over to my straight back chair and started singing Beautiful People. And Bruno Kokatrix was in exasperation, just, well, okay, no, we'll see what happens. And sure enough, I got rave reviews. It was incredible. I think they said I was Edith Piaf with a black soul. And so it was incredible. It flew in the face of everything that everyone thought, except for Gilbert Bécaud, because he had great faith in me.
That's a good story. That's really interesting. I liked your accent too when you did that. That was pretty good. It was really good. Your French accent, I like that. that was really good. What was the Woodstock experience like for you?
Oh, again, you know, I did have the Olympia Theater previous to that, but I was not a veteran performer, you know, and I really didn't know what to expect. I was in Europe, and before the whole thing started, for a year, I only knew that the people who were putting this on a year earlier were in the same office building as Peter, my husband, who was also my record producer. And they all thought it would be a good idea for me to be there. So I'm picturing like a picnic in the park, you know, like with families and picnic blankets and, you know, just a little sing-song thing with arts and crafts. It was going to be called the Aquarian Exposition. This is before they called it Woodstock. So I'm in Europe, and we were actually working on a film score. I was writing a film score, and I was very happy with, I didn't really like being the center of attention. You know, it was much more comfortable for me to be writing music and singing it, but not performing it in front of a lot of people. So that's what I was working on. And it seemed kind of crazy for me to go back and do this thing, you know. Maybe I should just stay here. And there, but my husband and I talked at great length, and we decided I should go back. He would stay in the studio and finish up this film score. And it was something called All the Right Noises with Olivia Hussey and Tom Bell. And again, that was kind of a big deal, you know, and John Campbell was the arranger, and the Rolling Stones were in the studio next door, and the London Symphony Orchestra were going to come in, and we were, you know, it was big stuff. So, but we decided last minute I would go, and Peter didn't go with me. I was by myself. My mom picked me up and drove me to Woodstock, my mother. So here I am doing something that 50 years later, people are still talking about it. But my mother picked me up, no big, you know, no nothing, no fanfare, no roadies, no band, no assistant, nothing. So we get to the festival finally through all kinds of traffic. And I realized that this is big. This is a big deal. This is a big deal. This is probably the biggest deal that anybody's ever done. So I get to this little hotel, because at first I was supposed to go somewhere else, and then I found out I was supposed to go somewhere else. Now, remember, no cell phones, no instant communication, no computer, nothing. And we finally get to this little strip hotel, you know, the kind of the doors and the cars are right, you know, you pull your car in, there's your door, that kind of motel. But there was a lobby, and I went into the lobby, and in the lobby there is Sly Stone walks by, and I'd never met a famous person. In France, Gilbert Bécaud, but I didn't, you know, this wasn't something that I grew up with, that I knew was a famous, but I had never met any of my peers. I'd never met. There was Janis Joplin, right? In lobby, she was surrounded by media and slugging Southern Comfort. And I thought, I have to get out of here. I have to get out of here. This is beyond my league. And I'm thinking I had to go, I have to get out. And I'm looking at my mother. My mother's like, ooh. And somebody came up to Melanie, let's go. And I went, oh, okay. And we start running, me, my mother, and this guy. And he said, right before we got into the helicopter, he said, who is she? I said, oh, well, that's my mother. He said, oh, no mother, sorry. Bye, mom, no moms. Oh, this is only for performers and state, you know, managers and musicians. So I didn't even have the savvy to say, you know, she's my roadie, you know, or anything. So I got in the helicopter all alone. No one was with me. Just by myself, I got into a helicopter and we descended the field, and I saw the stage and I saw the miles and miles of people, and the panic mounted and mounted. It was just, it was the most terrifying thing that ever happened to me up until that point. And that was led to a little tent. And at that point, I think Richie Havens was on. Now, I had heard about Richie Havens. He sang in the village, and he was kind of like the Pope of Greenwich Village, you know. And there he was. He was on stage singing, and he was in this wailing 50th minute of Freedom, Freedom, which was came out of, I think he was singing Motherless Child. And as I heard later, he said that they just kept saying, keep going. And he just kept going, and he broke into Freedom, Freedom. And I figured I was on next, because that's what the hurry was. Why otherwise? Why would they have put me in a helicopter? So I got to my little tent, and I did throw up. I threw up. I was so scared. I can't even tell you how scared I was. And I developed this deep bronchial cough, nervous cough. And it was like demons coming out of me. I was sure this was my doom, because all I was one girl who sang with one guitar. And, you know, nobody knew who I was in the States. There was a little bit of a buzz in in Europe, but in the States, there was only one DJ who played a record that he had gotten a hold of when it first came out on Columbia Records. It was called My Beautiful People, and he played it just because, you know, he got a hold of a copy. It was a time when a DJ could play anything they wanted. Of course, now it's completely controlled and everybody plays what they're supposed to play. But he played Beautiful People. So I would say maybe 1% of the entire crowd at Woodstock knew that one song. But I waited all day. And every once in a while, someone would come in and say, "You're on next." And then they would say, "Never mind." This went on all day long until the wee hours, and it had started to rain. And I thought, "Oh my God, my prayers have come true. It's raining. Everybody's going to go home. The whole thing will be called off. I'll go back to Europe. Everything will be as it was." And of course, that didn't happen. I was on next. It turned out the Incredible String Band had refused to go on because it was raining, and it's dangerous, right? So I didn't know anything about electricity. So when they said, "You're on next," I, got up and started to go on the stage. I actually left my body. I was in that much terror, I would say. And as I walked on the stage, I wasn't in my body anymore. And I didn't tell this story for a very long time because, people would say, "Oh, what kind of grass were you smoking?" But I was actually very straight. I was a vegetarian. I was a purist. I would never think of smoking anything for, breathing in any kind of smoke or anything, or altering myself in any way. So I had the pure experience of who I was, and my spirit and my body became two different things. And I rejoined myself when I started to sing on that stage. And I always thought the phenomena of me at Woodstock was that 500,000 people got to see me in two places, whether they know that or not. So it resonated. My performance went over amazingly. I mean, I got a reaction like I could never fathom ever receiving anything like that. And I watched the whole hillside light up with candles, because right before I went on, the MC made an announcement about Hog Farm, which was a commune, or not a commune, it was a collective. The Hog Farm Collective was gonna pass out thousands and thousands of candles. And he made some inspirational message to the people. And I didn't really know what he was saying, but I absorbed it. And after I was leaving Woodstock, it came out in that song, "Lay Down Candles in the Rain." Now, my husband said, "Call the song Woodstock." I said, "I can't call the song Woodstock. I didn't write a word. The Woodstock isn't mentioned in the song. I know it's called Candles in the Rain." He said, "Well, at least call it Lay Down," but he really wanted me to call it Woodstock. And all these years later, I really wish I listened to him. I'm sure in the realms of things, it would have become much more synonymous with the event than Candles in the Rain. But that was my little thing I wanted to do.
That's amazing. That's really inspirational, that story. That's got to be a wonderful experience. I got to let me in there. I mean, this being there in general would be amazing, I bet. I remember the song "Brand New Key" since I was a kid. That was one of my favorite songs, and it's very catchy and very fun. What was the inspiration to write that song?
it wasn't so much an inspiration. It just sort of popped out. I had been on a very long fast. I was, again, I was a vegetarian and I was questing. I was searching. What is it? What am I supposed to be doing? Why am I here? I want to be an archaeologist. Why am I becoming a famous person? And it was with all of that happening, I went to a, after this fast, my fasting guru, Dr. Bernard Jensen, who was the father of iridology in America, that's where they read the little dots in your iris and they can tell your weak and strong points in your body, and they can tell all sorts of things about nutrition and what you're supposed to do. He himself was a vegetarian, but he said that I really was not the right body type, facial type, he had and or blood type for being a vegetarian. So he thought that I should, after this fast, I should maybe consider eating meat once in a while to just help ground me. So I was horrified. I had spent, you know, years figuring out why it was so horrible to eat meat. And so when you find out all the things and how the animals are treated, what happens, and you're eating this adrenaline, and I just was appalling. But I mean, it's not like I didn't like the taste of meat. It was just the idea of it was just not sitting well with me. So when he said I should eat meat once a week, maybe twice a week, I thought, I can't do that. He said, well, you know what? You're going to go back. You break the fast very slowly on partially cooked steamed vegetables, and very slowly, you know, you break the fast with a teaspoon of juice, and because 27 days is a pretty long time not to have eaten anything but distilled water. And so I went home and I was on my way to a flea market. And this is the, you know, the 5 a.m. type flea markets. This is when early, there were no plastic things at a flea market. It was antiques, you know, old things that people had in their house and they wanted to get rid of them. And antique dealers would go and, you know, get bags of stuff and raise the price and sell them in antique shops. Well, I went, you know, as a novice antique dealer. I wasn't really a dealer, but I would, you know, go with my flashlight and look at the tables and I'd ask them, what's your dealer's price? And I'd filled a bag with things and all kinds of, you know, like antique farm equipment, all kinds of interesting things from other eras. I always loved old things. And I was in the car going back and I smelled this aroma and I looked and it was in a McDonald's. And I went into the McDonald's and Bernard Jensen said that my perfect diet is going to occur to me. Because I'm so cleansed, I will know what I'm supposed to eat. And sure enough, the voice inside of myself said, get a McDonald's. So I went in, we got the whole works, you know, the burger and the fries and the fiberglass milkshake, the whole thing. And I downed that last bite. Now, this is after being 27 days on water. You'd think a person would get sick, you know, from eating that, but it was great. And I had this whoosh of memory of remembering learning how to skate when I was little and riding a bike and my dad holding the back of the bike and I thought he was still holding, but he wasn't. I hear his voice in the back. And as soon as you know they're not holding on, you fall. But I was just having these memories coming back to me. And I started thinking about this song, and it just came out of that. You know, there was no, it's not like I was thinking, what should I write or how should I write it or anything. It just, it was there. So I wrote Brand New Key, and I really didn't think a whole lot of it. It was just a little ditty, you know, a little ditty that I wrote in the car. And I was just going over it, and my husband heard it. He said, "What's that?" I said, "Oh, that's nothing, little blues song or something." And he said, no, that's, sing that part again. I got a brand new pen. And so he said, "Melanie, we're going in the studio with that." I said, no. And he's, yeah. And when we got in the studio, he speeded it up a little bit. He said, "Yeah, we're going to speed it up a little." And I knew it was a hit record. I just knew it was going to be. And it also, I knew it was going to doom me to be cute for the rest of my life. You know, how can you get past that? And here I was. I was young, and I wanted to be considered a person with some relevance, you know. And but all these years later, I think, God damn, that was good. You know, I don't know what I was so worried about, really. But again, you know, when you're young and you take yourself a little too seriously, you know. And all these years later, I listen, I think, damn, that was a good song. I tried eating hamburgers after that, just for more, right, see if it could happen again. But
yeah, that's an amazing song. I love that song. You played at the Isle of Wight in 1970. How was that experience playing?
Well, I became kind of the festival queen. You know, I just, after Woodstock, because my career kind of just exploded after that, and which is really a kind of wonderful thing, because it was an organic growth, you know, because all those people saw me at that same time, and they'd never heard of me before, you know, so it was like a natural explosion. It wasn't manipulated, it wasn't manufactured. And in fact, I wasn't even on the first Woodstock album, because I was, you know, not considered anything. But the way my career grew from then, it was just explosive. And I performed at all the festivals after that. You know, every festival had to have Melanie, you know, so I did the Isle of Wight and Glastonbury and Strawberry Fields. And it was just, you know, every festival there was, I was the festival person. In fact, the state of New Jersey had booked me. They'd booked me for a performing arts outdoor seating event. And the night before the show, the governor of the state prohibited the concert because he said Melanie constitutes a festival and there are no festivals allowed in the state of New Jersey. So for a while that was my MO.
Regarding your albums from like the 70s, even into the 80s and the present, are you still doing a lot of folk elements still, or have you like branched out?
You know, I never really thought of myself as a folk singer, but I mean, all these years later, I was nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award for folk singer of, you know, I don't know what the category was, but a legacy artist or something. For being a folk singer. But I didn't really, because I had been there were so many elements in my music because I played a guitar and had long hair. I think that was, you know, that's, you're a folk singer. no matter what, you're a folk singer. And of course, there are very strong elements of folk music in my melodies, but some of my melodies are very Kurt Vile, really. They had that. I didn't play a piano, so it didn't, you know, when I, but in the productions, I would get to, you know, express what type of song it was. And I wrote everything from, I mean, really cabaret and folky, pop, rock, blues. I mean, Brand New Key is really a blues song.
Yeah,
that's it really something. Is. I mean, you could do that totally as a blues accompaniment. And a lot of people did, and look what they've done to my song, Lies. I don't know what you'd call it, almost like French chanteuse kind of Maurice Chevalier could have sung that, you know. Look what they've done to my, ils ont changé ma chanson. Anyway, for me, I was all over the map, and people would just say, well, what kind of music do you do? And I don't know, I just write songs, you know, and they come out the way they come out. You can embellish a song. If it's a real song with a real melody, you can do it in 100 ways. You know, you can make it sound like a rock song or a country song or bluegrass. In fact, I spoke with, on the way back from the Isle of Wight, I flew home with Jimi Hendrix. And we were talking about, he loved bluegrass. Bluegrass, those chords, you know. You could hear it like all along the Watchtower. And I mean, those chord progressions are very Appalachian. Yeah. And we were talking about that. And you just, because it's the trappings, you know, people get they believe that it's a rock song or it's a folk song because the girl has long hair and she plays a guitar. So must be a folk song. I was actually won Jazz Singer of the Year, which is hysterically funny to me now, at Montreux, the jazz festival, because I had Candles in the Rain and I was singing with a lot of Black people. It must be jazz. it was unbelievable, you know, the categories. I think with music, categories are the most inhibiting of things, you know, the whole idea that you call a particular song a this or a that, it just kind of limits the people who will listen. You know, this is like a marketing ploy. You know, it's nothing more than that, because people should be exposed. When I was growing up, radio was all over the place. You'd hear Patti Page and Frank Sinatra and then Elvis Presley or Bill Haley and the Comets, and you'd hear a folk song in the middle of all that. And that's what radio, pop radio was very, very varied. And then the marketing people and the scientific approach to manipulative sales became the rule. And so people are just shut out of so much that could enrich their lives, because they think, well, I'm this demographic and I wear those jeans and I have green hair, so I must listen to Billie Eilish or something. Or, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't care, you know, but it feels like so many people are losing out on an enriching musical experience by not listening to all the different types of music. Because they really could, music speaks to your soul, and the soul is not a demographic.
It does. It does. So I was going to ask you, I guess, one more last question then. This is a really good interview. I'm enjoying it very much. My last question would be, is there anything you want to add for my audience to know? Anything you want to add for that?
Anything I want to add? Yeah. Well, I think that my last observation and comment was probably right there with the last thing I would have said, is that, you know, people really need to open up to all the different kinds of music and be exposed to everything, not just what they're being sold. And I hope everybody will come to my live stream show. It's on March 27th, this coming Saturday at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Cool. Where can we find that at? On your website or?
It'll be on all my social media, and maybe you can help me tell people about it as well. And you'll have a little Woodstock in your life.
That'd be great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, I'm sorry to cut it short.
Everything's okay.
Oh yes. I'm sorry to cut it short. Really, I don't really want to do this.
That's right.
But I appreciate your time for doing this. I thank you. I learned a lot from you. Definitely, it was really amazing hearing you talk. I mean, you're a wonderful musician, and everything you do for charity is amazing as well.
Thank you.
Yes. Uh-huh. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Melanie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. The legendary folk singer Melanie. Very great interview, very great lady. I'm very honored to meet her. I think the interview went just as well as Peter Dobridge's interview I did prior to that one. There's no comparison. I mean, there is comparison. I mean, they're both very knowledgeable, both very informative of what they talked about. They made me feel like I was there with them, experimenting with they were doing in this period of music. And thank you for tuning in for this episode of the Mark and Acido podcast and Anchor podcast. Hope you enjoyed it, and see you next time. I'm back, guys, so enjoy.